طفلة تمتطي قوس قزح.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly 45-minute segment of news from Palestine and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's brutal military occupation and colonization of their homeland. This program presents news and analysis from the Palestinian perspective, a perspective we do not get from the mainstream media. We ask our listeners, as we do every week, were you involved last week in the Palestine-Israel peace movement and the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's savage military attacks against them to force them out of their homes and annex their properties into Israel? Did you speak out on the atrocities Israel is committing every day in Gaza and the West Bank? If not, what is your reason not to? It is Sunday, August 9th, 2009. We begin with a summary of news highlights. Last Sunday, August 2nd, the celebrated journalist and founding member of the Palestine Liberation Organization, Shafi El-Hout, passed away in Beirut, Lebanon, at the age of 77. A fierce fighter for the Palestinian cause, he enthusiastically participated in an oral history project to inform Palestinian children about their history. He once said, quote, "They want to erase Palestine from the memory of the new generation, and anything I can do to fight that, I would be more than happy." The Fatah conference in Bethlehem, which started last Tuesday, August 4th, will continue in session through today to attempt to resolve internal disputes. President Abbas stood unopposed for the leadership of Fatah and was elected yesterday to serve another term. As expected, Mr. Abbas used the conference as a pulpit to slam his rival faction of Hamas. Although calls were made in more than one stormy session for changes in the leadership and an end to corruption, little, if any, change is expected in that regard. At this point, one has little reason to call the conference a success. In an interview on Democracy Now! On August 5th, Amy Goodman asked Representative Henry Waxman, chair of the House Energy and Commerce Committee, quote, "Why aren't you opposing the Israeli government on the issue of the settlements that are called illegal under international law?" Here is what he said, quote, "Now, the Israeli settlement policy, I think, has to be changed, and I think that it's inexcusable to build settlements outside the block areas that everybody recognizes will be part of Israel when there's a settlement for land." Indeed. "I think the outlying illegal settlements should be closed, and I did say that to Prime Minister Netanyahu when I met with him in Israel." Unquote. When Amy Goodman pressed him on the question of why he did not call for the acceptance of the Arab League peace plan, which would normalize relations with Israel in exchange for full Israeli withdrawal from the occupied territories, he replied, like a good little boy who has learned his lines, quote, "Well, I don't think that the Arab League peace plan is clear enough that Israel would withdraw from territories and with whom they would make peace. The Palestinians are going through a civil war. Hamas's reason for being is to destroy Israel. The Fatah organization, we have high hopes that they will be willing to make peace, but they've never said that they're willing to recognize Israel as a Jewish state. And so Israel doesn't have a partner for peace. I wish he did. And the United States has got to try to promote that peace." Like all other congressmen, Henry Waxman clearly has been bought and paid for. Press the button and, like a well-trained puppet, he faithfully pipes out the lines he was taught to say. Democracy Now! Has also reported that on Thursday, August 6th, a group of Republican lawmakers met with Israeli officials in Jerusalem in what was billed as a solidarity mission. Republican Whip Eric Cantor of Virginia said after a meeting with Israeli President Shimon Peres, quote, "We are here first and foremost to reconfirm the message that the United States Congress stands staunchly on the side of Israel in its struggle, and we are here to figure out how to strengthen the U.S.-Israel relationship." House Democrats will follow up later this month with a 35-member delegation led by House Leader Steny Hoyer of Maryland. Needless to say that Representative Henry Waxman will join the delegation. All of this bodes ill for the much-heralded Obama Peace Initiative. We have received a preview of the nightmarish American view of the so-called two-state solution. Senator Evan Bayh, Democrat of Indiana, and Senator James Risch, Republican of Idaho, are asking colleagues to sign on to a letter they wrote on July 23rd to President Obama. The letter expresses support for Israel and puts the burden on Arab countries to make what they call dramatic gestures toward Israel. Senator Kennedy has not signed the letter and does not intend to sign it, nor does Senator Kerry. There may be hope yet for the U.S. Congress. Former United States President Jimmy Carter is expected to visit Gaza later this month with a delegation of elders, a group of global leaders brought together by former South African President Nelson Mandela. Meanwhile, we are finally beginning to hear from Israeli commanders, former Israeli commanders, admit to the abuse and beating of Palestinian children in their custody. Eran Efrati, a former Israeli military commander who served in the West Bank, told the BBC that allegations that soldiers like him often mistreat Palestinian minors are true. He said, quote, I'm quoting now Eran Efrati, you take the kid, you blindfold him, you handcuff him, he's really shaking. Sometimes you cuff his legs too. Sometimes it cuts off the circulation. He doesn't understand a word of what's going on around him. He doesn't know what you're going to do with him. He just knows we are soldiers with guns, that we kill people. Maybe they think we're going to kill him. Every soldier who was in the occupied territories can tell you the same story, he went on. The first months after I left the army, I dreamed about kids all the time. Jewish kids, Arab kids, screaming. Maybe the kid is blindfolded for him not to see the base and how we're working. But I believe maybe we put the blindfold because we don't want to see his eyes. You don't want him to look at us, you know, beg us to stop or cry in front of us. It's a lot easier if we don't see his eyes. When the kid is sitting there in the base, I didn't do it, but nobody is thinking of him as a kid, you know. If there is someone blindfolded and handcuffed, he's probably done something really bad. It's okay to slap him. It's okay to spit on him. It's okay to kick him sometimes. It doesn't really matter. Today we continue our discussion of Zionism and the permissive atmosphere it breeds for the dehumanization of Palestinians and the cruel and abusive treatment even of children. Our guest is Mr. Lenny Brenner, a prominent Jewish civil rights activist. Mr. Brenner opposed the Vietnam War from the first days of the war. He became involved in the American civil rights movement when he met James Farmer of the Congress of Racial Equality, later the organizer of the Freedom Rides of the early 1960s. He also worked with Bayard Rustin, later the organizer of Martin Luther King's 1963 I Have a Dream March on Washington. He was arrested three times during civil rights sit-ins in the San Francisco Bay Area, where he spoke frequently at rallies opposing the Vietnam War. He spent 39 months in jail when a court revoked his probation because of his activities during the Berkeley Free Speech Movement at the University of California in 1964. In the 1990s, he and Stokely Carmichael, the legendary Black Power leader of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, co-founded the Committee Against Zionism and Racism. Born into an Orthodox Jewish family, Mr. Brenner authored six books: Zionism in the Age of Dictators, The Iron Wall, Zionist Revisionism from Jabotinsky to Shamir, Jews in America Today, The Lesser Evil, A Study of the Democratic Party. In 2002, he edited the book 51 Documents, Zionist Collaboration with the Nazis, which contains complete translations of many of the documents quoted in Zionism in the Age of the Dictators and the Iron Wall. In 2004, he edited Jefferson and Madison on Separation of Church and State, writings on religion and secularism. His books have been widely translated and have been reviewed in 11 languages. I interviewed Mr. Brenner yesterday evening on the broad subject of Zionism and its role. Here is a recording of the interview. A follow-up discussion will be aired next Sunday.
Good afternoon, Mr. Lenny Brenner, and thank you for being our guest today.
Thank you.
As a scholar someone who has studied Zionism extensively and have written extensively about this, I would like to explore with you a wide range of issues, if I may. Perhaps we might have to have a two-part conversation, I'm not sure, but the issues are the ideology of Zionism, its single-minded goal of emptying Palestine of its indigent population of Palestinians in order to build a state exclusively for Jews, the hold that Zionism has on Jews to this day, even though it has not always had in mind the welfare of Jews, its identification with Judaism through the equation Jew equals Zionist, and other things if we have the time. Would you give us a primer on that subject, please?
Well, as you say, there's two subjects, so let's deal with how did Zionism come around, come about, or let's put it another way. This is, if you look at sort of the beginning of the 20th century, or a little before, let's say 1890s, that kind of thing. If you ask somebody to define a Jew, they would say, "Oh, a Jew. He's a member of the Jewish religion." Okay. Today, you have a situation where if you ask somebody to define a Jew, it turns out that most Jews aren't really religious anymore, but you have a Jewish state in Palestine, and which says that it is a Jewish nation. You can be religious, you can be an atheist, you're still an Israeli. Okay, so how did this shift come about? Well, if you look at the development of European politics, Zionism isn't really that unique. If you take, let us say, the time of the French Revolution, and you asked a typical European to identify themselves, they would say, "I'm a Catholic, I'm a Protestant, I'm a Muslim in the Balkans, etc." They identified themselves first religiously. If you came back a century later and asked them to identify themselves, they would say, "I'm French, I'm Polish, I'm Albanian." Okay? Some French were religious, some were not. Poles were, some were Catholic, some were were Jews, etc., etc. A change had taken place, and then other people were beginning to, if you ask them who they were, they would say, "I'm a worker, I'm a capitalist." Now, these were all new terms, as I say, which started out with somebody saying, "I'm a Catholic, I'm a Protestant, I'm a Jew, I'm a Muslim," etc. So there's a big shift. And it's very obvious, undisputed, that comes about with the rise of modern capitalist society, where all of a sudden you go from the horse and buggy age to the age of the telegraph and the telephone and, science and import-exports all over the world, etc. And people, as capitalism develops, everybody, the capitalist class, breaks down into national groups where you have the Germans who want to run Germany and the Poles want to have control of the Polish home market and so on and so forth. A big shift takes place. all over the world. So it's entirely natural that the Jews in Eastern Europe would go through some kind of similar shift like that, because if you take a country like Poland, the Jews were in effect the merchant caste. Like in India, they have, you know, the caste system. The Jews were the merchant caste in Poland, etc. And then all of a sudden, with the rise of capitalism, there were Polish Catholic capitalists who said, hey, you know, we want to run Poland and make money here. Why should the Jews have the market? And so on and so forth. So the idea that the Jews should go someplace else and make money someplace else, so to speak, it fit in. In other words, the rise of Jewish nationalism was in keeping with what was going on in universities all over Europe. As I say, the rise of nationalism out of the religious tradition. But what was exceptional was that these people who wanted, the Poles who wanted to run Poland, had a Poland to run. Whereas this Jewish notion, going back to Palestine, meant that you had to have the breakdown of the Ottoman Empire, etc., which neither the Jews nor the Zionists could possibly do on their own. And so they began to look around and tried to get the support of the British and the Germans and the French and the Italians, etc. I mean, literally, Herzl and other Zionists went from court to court. World War I breaks out. The British use them to try to get Jewish support for their side in the war, etc., etc., and they come in there. Still and all, they came in because the British won, not because the average Jew was interested in them. The average Jew in Poland wanted their rights in Poland. The average Jew had emigrated from Poland, or like my parents, they emigrated from the Ukraine, came to the United States. They wanted their rights in the United States. And many of them became leftists and so on and so forth. What shifted Jewish public opinion towards Zionism was the Holocaust. All of a sudden, the Holocaust takes place, and everybody starts worrying. All the Jews that are survivors in the United States, etc., are worried about what to do with the surviving Jews in Eastern Europe, especially as Joe Stalin is moving into Poland and so on and so forth. And basically speaking, these people, and I'm including my own family in this, I was 11 years old in 1948 when Israel was declared. And basically speaking, I can tell you that my family knew nothing about Zionism's history. Nothing. Okay? But all they knew was that it was a place for these refugees to go. And when Stalin supported the creation of the State of Israel, the Communist Party and the Jews in it, they supported it. So it was, I would say, 90% of the Jews in the United States supported the creation of the State of Israel, but knew nothing about the history of Zionism. I mean, you know, maybe out of that 100% of the Jews, who, as I say, 90% were for Zionism, they were for Zionism in that they voted for Truman because he created Israel, etc., but, or helped create Israel with Stalin, but they weren't members of Zionist organizations. They went to Zionist rallies for 5 minutes, so to speak, you know, and then after that, they really lost most interest in it. I know my family did, and I think my family was typical in that regard. What has happened since that time is a couple of things. Number one, at that time, most Jews were religious, and a huge number of that were Orthodox. Today, I would say about half trying to be cautious here. I would say at least about 40-50% of the kids who are born into Jewish families, when they grow up, become atheists. And those who stay religious, most of them are what they call Reform Jews, which are not recognized in Israel. In other words, their rabbis in Israel cannot perform legal marriages. So you have a tremendous contradiction right there. Most of the religious Jews in the United States are either Reform or Conservative, again, another sect, and again, not recognized in Israel. But what you have here in the United States today, I would say, is about 10% of the Jews in the United States are Orthodox. And they're the only sect of Judaism that is recognized in Israel. So you've had these tremendous shifts. Now, I would say this. If you take a typical Jewish kid on a college campus today, you know, a junior at Harvard, let's say, I would say he doesn't hang out particularly with other Jews, but he's not pro-Palestinian. And he doesn't hang out with other Jews and is not interested in Zionism because he doesn't see any reason why he has to be interested in Zionism. He's not having any problem being a Jew in the United States, and he's not having a problem being an atheist in the United States. He doesn't see why he has to go live in a Jewish state or anything like that. But, on the other hand, there's nothing particularly appealing right now coming out of the Palestinian movement that would attract him to anti-Zionism. I mean, you know, I know, your audience knows, you have two big wings, actually. I mean, there's more than two Palestinian groups. You have Fatah and Hamas. Hamas is having a convention right now. It's their first convention in 20 years. You know, I mean, that's where it's reported in the papers. And their delegate, Hamas won't let Fatah's delegates go from Gaza to the convention in the West Bank. So
neither will Fatah allow Hamas.
Yeah, right. You know, in other words, what I'm saying is that the you know, you have to have something that appeals to people. You know, when people see a problem, and as I say, many American Jews, you know, young kids, they see the problem in the fact that it's a Jewish state. They don't believe in a Jewish state anywhere. In other words, you take a typical Jewish kid at Harvard, he does not want an official religion in Boston. You understand what I'm saying, you know? I mean,
yes, but yeah. except when it comes to Israel.
Right, but no, you see, that creates a problem for him. In other words, right now, there are many kids on the campus at Harvard right now, this very minute, who, if you came to them and said, listen, Israel is an Orthodox Jewish state, is that good or bad? They would say, that is bad. Okay?
Well, yes, but when it comes to the political atmosphere, they will still support Israel when it says it wants to be recognized
right.
as a Jewish state.
Because they haven't thought it through, and there's nobody that's saying, look, if you're sincere, and they are, about they don't want a some kind of religious state, then you or some pro-Palestinian, me, what, you know, you me in the lamppost, as the saying goes, you know,
mm-hmm.
we have to say to them, look, here is the alternative state that should be there. Here is a movement to create a legitimate alternative to it. And now, I mean this quite, I'm making a proposition, an offer, you know, like they say in the mafia, an offer that you cannot refuse, you know. It's up to progressive Palestinian intellectuals and progressive Israeli intellectuals, not Jews, but, you know, in other words, I don't mean me in New York, but I mean guys who, you know, speak Hebrew and live in Palestine right now, you know, okay? It's up to you guys to pick a committee, ten people, five Israelis, five Palestinians, sit down and come up with a proposed constitution for a new state running from the water to the water, you know, from the river to the Mediterranean, so that I strongly believe this. Right now, there is so much discussion in the media as to what should be some kind of end game for Palestine, that if this kind of committee comes up with a draft constitution, it would get the attention of the media and become a focus of discussion.
Certainly, there have been suggestions and books written about a single democratic secular state.
I understand
but
that.
But as you say, no constitution has been drafted yet.
I use the word draft constitution to mean a constitution that you send out as a proposed constitution for people to discuss and make amendments, changes, before it gets passed. In other words, so that people are taking part in the discussion of the design of the constitution. In other words, I understand the reason I say this is that I'm the editor of Jefferson and Madison on separation of church and state, so I'm a deep student of the creation of the United States and its constitution and its impact on the world. You know, I mean, when the French made their revolution, they were trying to create the Republic of the United States in France, if you know what I mean, you know, literally. So what I'm saying is that at this point, it's up to those who live in Palestine or exiles on the Palestinian side, but with regards to the other side, it has to be people, Hebrew speakers, who are Israelis in the sense that they live in Israel. Okay, and not you know, some Israeli lives in Los Angeles, you know, that kind of thing. But you know, they want to identify with that country as their home. A draft committee of 10 people, five of the Israelis and five Palestinians, and I'm sure you can get, you know, five and five, 10 competent people to propose a draft constitution. It would get attention. It would and become a focus of discussion, because at this particular point, let me put it this way: I read what they call the Jewish community newspapers, Forward, which is a weekly here in New York. It's national. It comes out here, Jewish Week, Jewish Herald. All these they're all pro-Zionists, etc. But they are embattled. They know that when their Zionist kids go out on a college campus, there are anti-Zionists there. Jewish anti-Zionists, Arab anti-Zionists, you know, just plain American anti-Zionists, etc. And, you know, let me put it this way, they're winning the argument with the corrupt politicians, the Republicans and the Democrats, but they're not winning the argument on the college campus, and the college campus is the future of America and the world.
Would you, if you could, talk to us a little bit about the ideology of Zionism and its racist overtones?
Yeah, well, again, you see, as they shifted, as the different elements of the European capitalist class shifted from religion, they had to somehow come up with an alternative identity. If you were, what did being Polish mean if it wasn't necessarily absolutely equal to Catholic? Because this is true, you know, the whole Austro-Hungarian Empire and what you call Germany had Poles living in Germany, and Eastern Germany was Polish speaking, you know, all this kind of thing, you know. What began to permeate the entire European world was the notion of ethnic nationalism, which sometimes was simply enough a matter of language, but in other cases it became a matter of biological thing, because you had, number one, legal white racism in the United States. You had people adapting that kind of social Darwinism so that there were millions of people all over the world, or, you know, particularly all over Europe, who believed in that the white race or the Aryan race was duking it out with the Semites, the Hindus, the yellow people, etc. I mean, this was going on all over the world, this kind of ethnic identity.
We have about 10 minutes.
Yeah. 10 minutes left. Okay. But you get my point. In other words, under those circumstances, and what began to happen was that anti-Semitism in Europe began to change as the society evolved. What anti-Semitism at, let's say, 1789, you know, French Revolution in France meant was, you Jews, you killed Jesus, you killed the Messiah. You know? Okay. But if you look at anti-Semitism in, let us say, 1848, okay, in other words, you know, you have the revolution in 1789, another revolution in 1830, and then the big 1848 revolution, anti-Semitism meant literally, it wasn't anti-Jewish, it was that the Jews were Semites, okay? Now, I don't know your nationality, but when Richard Wagner was talking about Mendelssohn writing Jewish-style music, he meant that Mendelssohn, who was a Lutheran, you know, grew up as a Lutheran, he meant that Mendelssohn was a Semite, like Mohammed was a Semite. You get my point?
Yes.
Okay. So in that, just as easy in that kind of environment, where anti-Semitism became racial. I'm not shocked, as the saying goes, to see Jews saying, "Yeah, that's right. I'm a Jew because I'm a Semite." You know, yeah, that's right. Well, since I'm a Semite and Germany is for you Aryan guys, off I go to Palestine, you know? Now, the problem with that is, of course, that Palestine was inhabited. Now, I'll tell you something. Let me correct you on thing. The Vladimir Jabotinsky is the founder of Zionist revisionism, which is the movement of Benjamin Netanyahu and Olmert's party. Okay, I mean both parties come out of that same Zionist revisionist tradition. Netanyahu's father was Vladimir Jabotinsky's secretary. Jabotinsky's attitude was, look. We're colonialists. Let's not kid ourselves. We're taking over an Arab country, and it can only be done by force. It could be British force. It could be our force, but it's got to be done by force. But once we are the majority, the minority can stay. That was his, you know, hey, I'm a reasonable guy, you know? Once we're the majority, which has to be done by force, then we stay. Now, in the real world, what that really meant was what he was thinking about was sort of like how the America, the white colonists came to America, and the Indians wound up in Indian reservations and so on and so forth, and they got rights now, and you know, so on and so forth. But the problem is that Zionism came into Palestine too late, because this happened in 1917, let's say. By that time, and ever since, a literate Palestinian class has evolved, and they have the same demands that literate people have everywhere else. We want our rights, we want our national rights, we want our individual rights, we want our religious rights. We're not interested in any kind, you know, in being the Indians on an Indian reservation, et cetera, et cetera. The problem, though, with the is partly, though, and here I have to criticize the Palestinians. There's an old saying, a mountain only stands out because of the flatness of the surrounding ground. In other words, let us say Louis Napoleon survived until 1870.
We've got 5 minutes.
Yeah, because the French opposition to him didn't have its act together to overthrow him, you know. Mm-hmm. Now, I am applying that same principle to Zionism today. Zionism is in terrible trouble. They just had a riot in Jerusalem over the wicked mayor, I have to laugh, wanted to open a garage near the old city on Saturday, and thousands of Orthodox fanatics rioted against the idea of having a garage for tourist cars on Saturday, you know? I mean, the Zionists here are embarrassed by that, you know? I mean, they're worried that, oh my God, if this kind of thing keeps going on, then everybody in America is going to say it's the Jewish fanatics against the Arab fanatics. And support for Israel will decline. But what I'm also saying is that as long as the Palestinian, progressive Palestinians and progressive Israelis don't have their act together, then they are the flatness surrounding Zionism. You get my point.
I get your point. Yes.
Yeah, yeah. They have to come up with something positive. How many times have I heard, Israel equals Zionism equals apartheid. Well, if Zionism equals apartheid, where is the Palestinian equivalent of the African National Congress, the ANC? So what I'm saying is, set up a group like the ANC, which is, remember, was for 50 years, it was open to blacks, whites, Muslims, whatever, you know, down there. Set up some kind of group like that, based on a draft constitution like I just proposed. Yeah, you know, that you guys get together and come up with something that you can take to both the Palestinians and the Israelis and world public opinion. And I'm confident if you come up with a reasonable draft proposal, it'll get the attention of the world.
We have 3 minutes.
How many? 3 minutes, you say?
Yes.
Okay. But you get my point. In other words, look, you see, I was involved in the American Civil Rights Movement. I worked with Jim Farmer and Bayard Rustin, and I was in prison, in jail, I should say, with Huey Newton, and, you know, and I worked for about 12 years with Stokely Carmichael, and we set up a coalition against racism and Zionism. All right, and now Stokely Carmichael was one of the great figures of the American Civil Rights Movement. So I have some experience here in America on how to build movements against oppression. And I tell you that, as I say, since everybody talks about Israel and apartheid, the image is the ANC. Go, you know, get this committee going to draft the Constitution, have them look at the American Constitution and the South African Constitution. You see what I'm saying?
In other words, I see what you're saying.
Yeah, in other words, use them as models, you know, and come up with a Constitution. I mean,
1 minute.
Yeah, I mean, South Africa has terrible problems, okay? But what is amazing is there are about 500,000 whites in an overwhelmingly black country, and they're there. No, you know, there are riots, blacks against blacks on certain issues, but it's not a racist country against whites. So if they could do that there, then the Palestinians and the Israelis can live together.
Thank you. Mr. Brenner, I think we've run out of time. And this is a big subject. I hope that we can continue this on another edition, and that we will have a second or perhaps even a third part to our conversation.
Thank you very much
for being our guest today.
Well, that conversation unfortunately did not touch upon many aspects of the subject that I was hoping to have treated. But there is one valuable suggestion, I think, that Mr. Brenner made, and that is to write a draft constitution for a single, secular, democratic state with equal rights for all. That state, as a solution to the current problem, has been discussed elsewhere, has been written about, books have been written about it. But this is really the first time that some flesh can be put on it and help make it the subject, the focus of discussion in the future. And that is all we have for today. We wish our listeners a pleasant and restful weekend and look forward to having you with us next week, same time. Until then, this is Sharif Fahm signing off for now and reminding our listeners to get involved. Get involved.